So I love speaking at conferences where they insist on putting your credentials after your name. So I'm the one that only has the BA and not the PhD. My mom, who's always wanted me to be a doctor, would love that I'm on this presentation, on this panel. So John Kim, I'm the co-director of the Advancement Project. Let me just say a little bit about who we are. But before I do, no disclosures to share. So the Advancement Project started about 15 years ago. Next generation civil rights organization. I like to say we're not your mama's civil rights organization. We, as a national organization, we have offices in D.C. and they do a lot more work around voting rights and ending the schoolhouse to jailhouse track. I run the California office, and so I'll speak more to that work there. Core principles and what sort of why we look at ourselves as a next generation organization. First, we come to realize that any issue that we face is no longer a single race issue, but a multiracial sort of issue. And so we need to have more multiracial platforms and approaches. And so that's first and foremost about how we approach the work. Second, some of the tools that as civil rights movements in the past have so successfully used, you know, the rules have changed. The universe has shifted a little bit. And so we need to experiment and create new approaches and new tools. And so that's also what we do. We test our staff. We say, hey, come in, come up with a new way of doing things. Take the risk. If you fail, we'll figure it out. We'll go on to the next. Building unlikely alliances. We're all about trying to figure out how we on the left have done such a horrible job disenfranchising ourselves from the conversation a lot of times. We're so sure we're right, and that makes us very sure that everyone else is wrong. But, you know, in the end, it's the dialogue, it's the engagement that's important. So, you know, we've seen huge dramatic shifts. 52% decline in gang-related shots fired in L.A. County, or I'm sorry, in L.A. City, because we got the police and the gang interventionists to work together, right? We get, you know, sometimes the teachers' unions and the reform efforts to come together to figure out what's right for the schools and the children, right? We get, you know, grassroots folks and electeds, cats and dogs, greasers and socias. We get them all together and try to make them all kind of work a little bit more nicely. And then finally, deep systems and policy analysis. You know, part of what we asked our staff to do is to just blink and look at a system and understand how structural racism has unfortunately been embedded in many parts of those systems that we're trying to deal with, and to figure out how to, you know, change the right levers to actually improve those systems so they work for all communities. Here's a list of our programs. I'm not going to go through all of them. In California, I'll just say that we do a lot of work around early care and education and K-12, a lot of work around public funding, particularly at the local level, and understanding that too often advocates will say, hey, we should do this, and the answer they get is, we actually don't have the money for that. And so we've built a curriculum and tools for community groups to actually say, no, I looked at your budget, and you actually do have the money for it. And that's actually worked. Healthy City, I'll speak a little bit more about today. And then our Urban Peace Program, they've led the charge around the gang intervention work that I just had mentioned. They had looked at how you look at gang issues and violence in L.A. More as a public health issue as opposed to a law enforcement and suppression issue. And through a lot of research, but more so some political strong-arming and real engagement with the mayor, transformed how L.A. thought about its gang problem and also transformed our position as the gang capital of the U.S. to actually the gang solution capital of the U.S., and so quite a bit of work in that area. Let me just start my presentation here talking about Healthy City. 13 years ago, I was asked to come and start this program for the Advancement Project. I only have a BA. It's in music and psychology, and so I wasn't totally sure what I'd be doing with this, but I was an organizer before I came to work at a policy shop. And I did know that you get shooed away too quickly as an organizer, as an advocate. And if you have data, that actually can be power. And if you have information, that actually can nullify some of the politics that you have to deal with. And so I was on board to try to start this platform. Of course, I didn't know it was called GIS mapping at the interview. I was like, GIS mapping, word, I could do GIS mapping. Yeah, let's do that. But we decided to create healthycity.org, which is sort of the Google Maps. you know, Google Maps is for commerce and traffic and directions. HealthyCity.org is about, you know, community change and actually understanding what's going on in communities. Beyond the website, we do a lot of direct engagement and partnership with foundations, a lot of our partners here we've worked with. And then also, because we don't want to be the only geeks in town that know how to use this stuff, we started a thing called the Community Research Lab, which trains community groups on how to use data, technology, for their particular pushes. The website, you know, a most comprehensive list of services. You can map them out and know exactly where your mental health services are, your health clinics, your schools and how well they're doing. A lot of tables and charts, interactive data mapping. Because we feel that in the end, all data sets are incomplete, we wanted to make sure that we created ways so it's a two-way dialogue, and so that communities can map their own data, right? So take a spreadsheet, load that up. Take a picture on your phone, load that up, so that it actually can play alongside with the administrative database that we also hold so dearly. And then, again, to tell your community story. So let me just do a real quick run-through on something that you can see here. That's South L.A. The 110 freeway is going up and down there. The big red blobs, I don't know if that's the correct scientific term for that, but the big red blobs actually show where there are the highest concentrations of firearm-related hospitalizations. Okay, that's overlapped where there's the more green areas, which where there's the highest concentrations of youth, unfortunately. Right? So intensive numbers of youth who are exposed to the trauma of seeing gun violence. And folks are getting shot, so they need to get to the hospital. So let's hope there are hospitals right where those big red blobs are. And unfortunately, that's not the case. Right? That's actually where they aren't. Right? That's where the sort of donut is. And so I guess society in general is saying maybe instead of getting to a hospital, you should medicate yourself some other way. And so here are all the alcohol outlets in the area. And so we wanted to get this data out there. We wanted to create an interactive platform so that people can pull this data down and tell their own stories, right? But we also know you can't make change just from a website. Really, what's that about? And so we decided to really embark on engaging on the ground with our partners to deal not only with the policy and the research, but also to deal with the politics. And again, as an organizer, this is sort of where my heart beats. I was a little bit sick of, you know, policy shops coming in and saying, you know, we know better about what you should do in your community, and then learning from what we did on the ground and then getting all the funding for what we're doing. And so we wanted to say, hey, how do we actually partner with folks on the ground and be with them in their particular struggles? Now, the conditions are good to do this work in California. And I will be very clear that we have particularly good conditions, and it may not be the case in all parts of the country. But right now, there is political cohesion in California between Dems and Republicans and folks up and down the system to say, hey, let's localize decision-making as much as possible, right? Now, that wasn't always the case, right? There are folks that said, no, put everything in Sacramento, or which is our capital. But right now, there's this sort of cohesion around, no, let's localize a lot of these decisions. I will also say in the past 20 years, there's been huge growth and evolution in our community organizing capacity. There are networks like the California Calls, which is an alliance of mobilizing groups up and down the state, PICO California, really leaps and bounds from 20 years ago. I recall 20 years ago watching L.A. burn during the L.A. uprising because we could not get it together as a progressive movement, and because we didn't have the proper tools to fight back against entrenched, deep racial oppression. But now we're seeing much more ability for communities to rise up, step up, and engage in that conversation. And so we have a new condition around being able to partner with communities. We're also much clearer about our limitations, what any one group can particularly do. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. And then we are seeing some shifting demographics. We're taking some of the lessons learned on the coastal urban areas where there is capacity, and as much more communities of color are shifting inland in California, we're seeing, okay, how do we take some of those tools and build some of that capacity from scratch in those areas? So we've got some good conditions in California. Our approach to doing this work is fairly elementary, very much aligns with what folks here have already talked about. A lot of it aligns with sort of a community-based participatory action research framework, but again, you know, we also want to always play that political edge. How do we really kind of push this from a racial justice lens? So on one hand, build an analysis and back it up with research. Again, ideally doing that with our partners. Triangulating the quantitative data research with the community-based participatory action research methods. Kind of like five blind men or people around the elephant. We don't exactly know what's going on until we sort of dialogue and engage each other. Once we have that analysis, engaging movement partners, particularly, as I've said before, organizing groups, and creating a space for a common diagnosis and a common set of solutions with them. And then, in some way, and this is a subtlety, and it's a dance, transferring ownership over that fight, right? And saying, hey, this is your fight, now we're here to support you. Finally, don't let them be. We should support them as much as possible from all different sort of angles, from policy shops and foundations and what have you. Collaborate with them on political engagement. Provide and share resources and access. There have been many times where we can get the superintendent or the mayor on the phone, so hey, why don't we share that with you in this particular fight? And then do what we can to co-pilot and to co-learn with them as they move forward. So let me show you guys a few examples of this. A partnership, again, with the Community Coalition, which also Rachel talked about. So the Community Coalition, extraordinary organizing group in South L.A., understand that South L.A. is shifting, and so they organize both black and brown, both African-American and Latino communities down in South L.A. They've done all this tremendous work after the uprising around shutting down liquor stores, but there are still real pockets of issues in South L.A. And so they said, hey, can you come in and help us figure out where we should do a place base, but one that's focused on organizing? Where can we do a campaign like that? And so we did the data. We got the geeks to come in and do the mapping and crunch the data. as we were kind of going through this, they looked at the data, they talked to their communities, and they actually found this particular neighborhood. And this particular neighborhood stood out to them not only because the data said so, but also because community members pointed out a particular intersection or a couple of intersections where there was a brand new library that the city had invested in. And it had a park right next to it, and up the street was a school that the school district was investing in. There's all these assets. We should all feel very good about what was going into that neighborhood. But what surrounded those resources were a recycling center, a liquor store that at the parking lot actually had sofas set up in the parking lot, which meant, you know, hey, have a seat, have a drink, and then pay by the hour motels all around that. You add in some broken lights, you add in a bunch of vacant lots, and those assets that the city had invested in were, for many people, unusable. They actually could not walk. Kids felt unsafe using that park or accessing that library. Okay? And they said, you know, someone said in the community, it was sort of, you know, we talk about infrastructures for health. This is a sort of infrastructure for no good, right, happening in that area. And so we said, all right, well, let's work with you on figuring out how we could dig in a little bit deeper on this. And so what we did with the coalition is we launched this sort of community-engaged mapping process, right? And we've been doing this now for about 10 years. We did it to shift $50 million in preschool into the right neighborhoods. We've done it to look at health access and resources and other neighborhoods. In this particular example, we asked the community, there was 120 community residents that came out to a session, said, map out where you feel unsafe. Map out where it doesn't work for you. And tell us a little bit about why. Right? It's an extraordinary session, right? I mean, there is a lot that data could tell us about what's going on in a neighborhood. It doesn't tell you the story about the fact that a kid, when they get dropped off from their bus stop, has to book it, has to just run as fast as they can, no matter how heavy their backpack is, because otherwise they're going to get punked by the local gangs before they get to school, right? It doesn't talk about how we're in the parking lots behind the stores. There are these things called trunk transfers where two cars are kind of back up and open their trunks and stuff is moved from one to the next, right? We don't see that necessarily in the data. And so talking to these community residents, we were really able to identify exactly where they put their dots and what was going on, and then do our geeky magic on it and understand here are some of the hotspots,
here's really where we need to focus, right? And what I loved about this, A, it gives us good data, right? You can see around the park here, I wish I was taller, but in that little area right there, you know, people, again, felt extremely unsafe in that area. Right around the school, a couple blocks north of that, same situation. Both not only in front, but also behind the school. Okay. What I also loved about this is it meant that the advocates, when they went to City Hall, when they spoke to the powers that be, it wasn't just their voice, right? It was actually 120 residents from the community saying, no, this is exactly our day-to-day experience, right? And so it adds that power. It also lifts up and changes the power dynamic somewhat in those meetings, right? The last thing I love about this kind of thing is that a resident can actually put a sticker on a map one day and hopefully see some change, right? And that's what happened. Actually, the coalition not only looked at where these issues were, but also where are the assets to really lift up again, engaged the city and the school district. The city eventually, not only because of this, but because of their political acuity and pushing, refurbished the park, was about to shut down that liquor store, but the liquor store actually came too and decided to get rid of the sofas, actually redo some of the lighting, put in a security guard, and actually change some of the what they offered inside the liquor store. So there's actually a little fruit stand there as well now. They redid a lot of the, they dealt with some of the vacant lots and emptied some of the trash. They did quite a bit of work here, fixed some of the lights up. And now, 5 years later, we've done the assessment, and not only have we seen huge outcomes in terms of the health outcomes here in this area, but now on an annual basis, they host this thing called the Power Fest there, right? And so hundreds of people come out every summer now and reclaim that space, right? We take our kids to this event every year, and it's extraordinary. You feel the community kind of coming together around this particular space. And so it is about, again, how community can reclaim and build some of this power. The last example I'm going to take here is around a push that we just did this year. The state of LA, or state of California, it feels like a state sometimes. The state of California actually redid its school financing formula for the first time. It decided to focus on equity. It said if a school district that has more of those types of students, you'll get more money, which is extraordinary, right? Huge win. One of the big problems, though, is that the state, it said, okay, well, what you do at the school district with that more money, it's kind of up to you, right? And again, more localized decision-making and more space for trouble, right? We partnered with the Coalition, Inner City Struggle, and several other community organizations that said, hey, first of all, this is insufficient. There's much more that we need to understand about these kids and their communities to target these dollars. So instead of just doing those three variables, why don't we understand these other variables as well? Right? How frightened does a kid have to be as they walk from home to school for them to be able to learn? What's their exposure to violence? What's their accessibility to programming, to ECE, so the health outcomes, so on and so forth? How do we understand sort of globally what's going on with these particular kids? Right? We then mapped out every single school. And again, the red schools are where they rank very high in terms of that high need, that aggregate student need index. And that's South LA, where you see the red dots, East LA, parts of the valley. And then talking to organizations in those areas, we also then said what should be done with that money if it gets there. And so we created this comprehensive sort of framework that says the money should be used for educational supports like expanding ECE, health services like mental health supports and expanding school-based health centers, youth safety in terms of restorative justice practices, and other positive school discipline issues, and then community and stakeholder engagement. How do we build up more capacity to do that kind of engagement? The community groups sort of own this. They did their own campaigns with their own youth saying, hey, if I go to this school, then this is what it means. 5 times more likely for this, 10 times more likely for that. And then we did the campaign. We pushed. We actually engaged the superintendent on this particular issue. We engaged the politics of the school board. That was a little hairy because we had our school board members that we always worked with, and then there's been this fissure between reformers and teachers unions, unfortunately. And so we reached out to the teachers union and said, hey, how do we bring this together? How do we actually see this as a common good for all of us? And they eventually brought forth all of their school board members as well. We push on the politics. What I love here is that we have 300 high school students from South LA and East LA wearing t-shirts with the word index on it. Okay, that's not something that's cool for teenagers to wear a t-shirt that says the word index on it. And they did this about, a few times over the course of a couple of months to put pressure on the school board, and eventually a school board resolution was passed that said $837 million needs to be allocated to the highest need schools given the kind of index and research that the Advancement Project had done. Right. And so it was a huge win for these kids. Right. So again, why do we do this? As B has mentioned, true community health doesn't happen when something is done for community, but when the community has the power to kind of do for itself. And again, understanding our limitations, we can't be everywhere at all times. And there's a lot of ways no good can happen in the political system and policies. And so we got to build up the capacity of communities to stay there and to stay on those elected officials and to keep folks accountable for some of these changes and for some changes that need to happen in the future. So that's all I got. Thank you so much.
So we have such great presentations that we're a little on the longer side. We're officially out of time. But I know that some of you want to ask questions. And I know there's a little bit of time before the next round of presentation. So let's go ahead and do a couple of questions if people can stay. And I know that some people have to leave to catch planes. No, I mean the next round or whatever. So, anybody has to leave or should we just keep going? Okay, questions over here.
Thank you for the excellent presentation. It seems like it's a critical moment. Somewhere where we work on collaborative action with chronic disease was 15 years ago. An opportunity for those early empirical case studies to show the relationship. What amount in kind of changes between the systems it takes to move indicators related to health activity. And I wonder kind of where people see the field being in terms of the measurement and the capture, if you will, of the multiple and interrelated changes in the environment that are going to need to occur in order to meet those indicators, and weighting those by intensity and duration and the strength of strategy so that we can reach, so that we can get a sense of what kind of measures of intensity are necessary to tip population level outcomes.
We don't have a mic out there, so just talk loudly. Whoever wants to answer.
Even though I looked the part, I actually am not the data log in my office, so I'll actually defer to some other folks on this.
Steve, I think that's a great point, that we absolutely need a more refinement of equity measures. Measurement is key to accountability, but I think we also need to do a better job of making the data, democratizing the data, making it real for people in communities so that they have that data at their disposal, not in some technical way, but as John so beautifully illustrated, as a way to hold people accountable.
Over here?
Two real quick questions.
Do you mind standing so we can all hear things?
It's incredible work, obviously, 10-year funding. Could you just say a quick summary of what was the decision-making process for those communities, because that's amazing. And then Brian, real quick, talk about thinking of redevelopment in cities. How do you do that at that situation? We know our cities from California, LA, San Diego, 50 years ago, downtown was horrible. So what happened is, we all know, low-income people got displaced when that economic development happened. Mm-hmm. Just talk a little bit about that.
I think for us, we're a pretty young foundation, and we looked at the strategies. We had funded over 35 different strategies. And when we honed down, we did a deep dive and looked at what worked and what didn't work. So we had a real moment of honesty and said, wow, we didn't really see movement. And we said where there was a sweet sauce was where there was local capacity building and change and statewide policy. So how do we marry those two together for greater impact? again, sort of the population health approach, like what could we do? And then prior to that, we had about three or four different place-based approaches, and we learned from that. One with farm workers, working with in the Central Valley with several farm workers, and we didn't have any frame. We said, we'll let community decide. It failed. It took 5 years, and there was no, you know, sort of outcome. We worked in the space of healthy eating and active living with systems leaders. But what we learned from that is there were great movements within the system, public health, local cities, et cetera. However, people in the community didn't feel that anything had changed in their environment. So we sort of learned from our own mistakes, to be honest with you, and we also looked at what was going on across the country. We looked at, you know, what was going on with the Harlem Kids Zone. But again, the replication of that, very complicated, because again, they have really great metrics and great data. However, the model is very different, so we knew that we would have to experiment, take those lessons learned, and then put our money in those places and take a chance. It's messy business.
Any other questions?
I'll talk with you later about that.
Okay.
We generally do shows like this, but we are considering, exactly right, we are considering packaging some of this learning, again, alongside our community partners, and so once that kind of gets pulled together, we'll definitely reach out to you all about that. Thanks.
Any more questions? Great, well, thank you very much. Let's give a big hand up.